Hey everyone, welcome to the Faith Chapel podcast. We are so glad to have you join us. Faith Chapel exists to help people follow Jesus, be transformed by Jesus, and be on mission with Jesus. No matter where you are on your spiritual journey, you're welcome here. If you have any questions about who we are or what you hear, you can visit faithchapel.cc or email podcast@faithchapel.cc. We'd love to hear from you. All right, let's dive into this week's message. Hello, everybody. My name's Nate. If I haven't met you, thanks for being here. Thanks, everybody who's tuning in. Appreciate you being here as well. So we've been in a series where we're just taking one book from the Bible, and we're studying it fairly in depth, and we're at chapter 11. And so this is a book. It's written about 55 AD by the Apostle Paul to a group of people who are trying to figure out how to be followers of Jesus when they live in a culture that is not conducive to being a follower of Jesus. They live in a Greek culture. It's the first church that we know of that's made up predominantly of non-Jewish people. They're Greek. And so Corinth has this ancient history, and they have come to, in chapter 11, they've asked questions of Paul. We don't have the questions, but Paul writes this letter in response to the questions. They've come to one of the most fundamental and one of the most ancient questions and problems that has plagued human beings for millennia. Okay? It's ancient. It has its roots going back to the very beginning of time. And here's their challenge. They're trying to figure out how two genders, male and female, can live together in the same world and in harmony. And they have problems that there are men who are oppressive, and they have problems with women who are aggressive, and like the whole thing's just befuddled and convoluted, and they're just asking Paul, like, how do we work our way through this? So you know, this is like one of the oldest problems that we have. And so in Corinth, in 55 AD, this was a really big deal. Guess what? We're 2,000 years later, and we haven't quite figured it out, have we? We're still, this is just one of the primary things in our culture where we're trying to figure out, how do we do this? And then in today's world, like you guys know, I don't have to talk about it, but gender is at the top of so many conversations, and it's not just tension between men and women, but people who are uncomfortable in the body they were born in, and like identity issues, all that. That's all part of the same root problem. So we're going to read this text, and here's what I need from you. Just hear me. We're going to read some things. Some of it's cultural. And ladies, some of it is just going to make you want to, like, grind your teeth and, like, what? Okay, here's what I need you to do, though. Let's hang in there, okay? So don't leave when I read the passage. Give me 30 minutes. That's all I'm asking for. Do not turn off your computer, right? Until we walk our way through this passage, because some of it is like, okay, that was for Corinth, but then Paul has these like really deep principles that he is calling the people in Corinth to live out gender in a completely different way than society lived out gender. Okay, so these are just some fundamental truths that I think would help us navigate. Even if you're not yet a follower of Jesus, we call it being spiritually unresolved. This is going to make sense, that somebody 2,000 years ago pointed us towards a solution, right? You ready? Let's read together. 1 Corinthians chapter 11, begin at verse 2. You ever heard of a compliment sandwich? Where you say something nice, and then the rough stuff, and then you say something nice at the end, like to make it more palatable. Yes, I praise you for remembering me in everything and for holding to the traditions just as I pass them on to you. So he says, thank you for being so attentive and paying attention and respecting my leadership. But I want you to realize that the head of every man is Christ. Okay, makes sense. And the head of the woman is man. And the head of Christ is God. Okay, wait a minute though. He puts Jesus in there, Christ. And so one of the things that's really, really important to understand this passage is when we think of the word head or authority, we think in a hierarchical fashion. Okay, hierarchical. Which means that the farther up you are on the list, the more important you are. So think of it where you work. Your organization chart, right? the top third of the list of the organizational chart loves the organizational chart. Nobody else does, right? Because if you're up here, you're important, you're paid better, you have more value that you bring. This is not hierarchical, okay? Our minds go there as Westerners. He's saying, listen, there is a relationship between Jesus and the Father that's not hierarchical. It's not based on power or worth. It's based on mutuality. And he says, that's what's happening in the male-female relationship as well. Let's go on. Every man who prays or prophesies with his head covered dishonors his head. But every woman who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered, so the opposite, dishonors her head. It is the same as having her head shaved. Okay, we'll talk a little bit about this because this is going to be one of Paul's big deals. But you would want to know this. In Roman culture, if there was adultery in a marriage, the man went unpunished. Okay, there were no expectations. Here's how the Romans dealt with adultery. The woman was taken into the town square, wherever she lived, and her head was shaved as a way to shame her and signify to everyone who saw her that she had been caught in some form of adultery. So this is a humiliation. For if a woman does not cover her head, she might as well have her hair cut off. But if it is a disgrace for a woman to have her hair cut off or her head shaved, then she should cover her head. A man ought not to cover his head, since he is the image and glory of God, but woman is the glory of man. This is from Genesis 3. We'll get to it in a moment. For man did not come from woman, but woman from man. Neither was a man created for woman, but woman for man. It is for this reason that a woman ought to have authority over her own head. Okay. Paul is like one of the most rational, brilliant people. And then there's this verse. I probably read 100 different resources over the past 2 weeks. What is because of the angels? And no one knows. Like all my heroes, my theological heroes, they're like, very difficult passage. Who knows what the angels are? Okay, so here's what I would suggest. If you're in a discussion and it is getting kind of confusing, this is how you can end it. Well, because of the angels. And nobody knows what to do with that. They're like, what do you mean? Because of what angels? You just walk away. Just walk away because of the angels, right? So we don't know exactly what Paul is referring to. Culturally, there must have been something that they're like, oh yeah, because of the angels. But 2,000 years later, like, what angels? Okay, so move on. I'm going to answer a lot of questions today. Not that one. Nevertheless, in the Lord, woman is not, ooh, this is important, is not interdependent of man, nor is man, excuse me, independent, nor is man independent of woman. This was a radical phrase, okay? In Roman culture, women were owned as property, okay? As property. A Roman woman cannot own anything. It couldn't be registered in her name. He says they're not independent. Instead, he says they're interdependent, for as a woman came from man, so also man is born of woman. Like every human being owes their existence to a woman, right? We all came from them. But everything comes from God. Ultimately, he's in charge. Judge for yourselves. Is it proper for a woman to pray to God with her head uncovered? Does not the very nature of things teach you that if a man has long hair, it is a disgrace to him, but that if a woman has long hair, it is her glory? For long hair is given to her as a covering. If anyone wants to be contentious about this, we have no other practice, nor do the churches of God. Basically, just shuts them down, right? If you want to have a problem with this, there's no other option. Whew, okay, there's our passage. What is happening? How does this relate to us today in terms of gender? First, I just want to tackle a few questions, okay? Here's some questions that I think we ask. If you're a woman, if you're a man with long hair, you're like, oh man, do I like have to cut my hair after church? If you're a woman with short hair, it's like, oh no, do I have to grow my hair now? I'm looking around, no women with head coverings. Do we need to start offering those before you come into church? What's going on? First question, what are the cultural realities or the context that help us understand this passage? Second thing is this, what was Corinth's understanding of masculinity and femininity, right? They obviously had their own understanding, because here today in our world, we have an understanding of what masculinity and femininity look like, right? But I'll tell you what, most of that is not biblical. Most of our understanding of femininity and masculinity is more cultural. We've just adopted these things over a period of time. What does authority, what does headship, these terms that Paul is introducing, what do those actually mean? Is it hierarchical? Because if so, we've got to read this passage in a certain way. If it's not, if it's about relationship and mutual submission and respect to each other, that means something different. Does this passage apply to all male-female relationships or just to the marriage relationship? Well, Paul never mentions marriage in this passage. He's talking about gender interactions in general. Should I dismiss this passage as antiquated, as old, as so culturally specific, it has nothing to do with me today? Or do we come at the passage, and this is what I would argue, is we want to learn the principles. We want to identify the cultural issues, but Paul is bringing in some deep principles as well for us to learn from. Here's my final question. Historically, how has the church understood this passage and other passages that have to do with gender? Do you know that denominations, churches have split over this? And denominations have been formed over this? So here's kind of the two parties. And I'm not big on it's either this or that, because what I find that happens, if you join this side, then you can't get along with people on this side. I think we're looking for the biblical truth. So here's how the church, though, has kind of handled this. One group of churches would be known as complementarian. Okay, complementarian. Even from the root word, you can kind of understand that. And a complementarian perspective on gender in the church would say this: men and women have equal value and worth. However, men and women have very different roles to play, and there are some roles that are inappropriate for a man to play, and there are some roles that are inappropriate for a woman to be involved in. Okay, so many complementarians would be super conservative. At a complementarian church, they would say pastors, teachers, people who teach the Bible, not a job for women. Okay, and then a lot of complementarians would even say in society in general, there's roles that are only for men. So that's complementarian. Who would fit into the complementarian role? Southern Baptists, Roman Catholics, most Lutherans, although there's some exceptions, Mennonites, Presbyterian, Reformed churches. Okay, so that's complementarian. Now, the other side of it is called egalitarian. You'll notice the root word equal. Egalitarians say, oh yes, equal worth, equal value, and we don't believe that there are specific roles that are just for men or just for women. In fact, it's open to all, okay? So there's no like, because you're a woman, you can't do this, or because you're a man, you can't do this. Egalitarian role would say, hey, if she's got a great job and she wants to go to work and he wants to stay home and take care of the kids, that's fine. Egalitarians, like, we have women pastors on our staff, so we would be a little bit more this way. And so who's egalitarian? You would have multiple denominations. Some of them you might be familiar with would be like, we're part of a movement called Foursquare, Episcopalian, Evangelical Free, Free Methodist, Friends, Mennonites, some Presbyterians, United Methodists, and Wesleyans. So this has been a big deal. Like, I'm sad to tell you, like, the church hasn't really figured this out very well. Let's dig in and see what Paul has to say. Here's point number three. First, we got to do some cultural differences. I told you we'd do that. So number two, cultural differences. What can we know about what's happening in first century Corinth? Here's some cultural differences that might help us understand the passage. Number one, what's the deal with men not having long hair? Okay. I recently saw a picture of our wedding. This is it. Long hair is the disgrace to a man. I don't know why. 30 years ago when we got married, I thought my hair was awesome. But it was like short on the sides, super long, puffy, curly in the back, you know, and kind of a cheesy 1990 tuxedo. And I looked at it and I'm like, why didn't anybody tell me I look so weird, right? At the time, I thought it was fantastic. So why is Paul saying men shouldn't have long hair? So like guys in the room, if you have long hair, here's what was happening in Corinth, okay? The only men In Roman culture, that had long hair, were men who were advertising their homosexuality. So if a man had long hair, you were very publicly displaying your sexual orientation. No other men had long hair. If you'll notice, even go back and look at like ancient statues, all Roman men, all Middle Eastern men always have short hair. Even to this day, you will not see that out there. So back then it meant that you were homosexual. What does long hair mean today? It means like you're part of the worship team or in a band or, right? It just doesn't have the same implications at all. It just means that you've always wanted to have a man bun, okay? So it doesn't mean the same thing. Now, how about the short hair with the women? Why does Paul say you just don't want to do that? You don't want to shave your head? There were only two groups of women in Corinth who had short hair, and they were distinguished in a couple of ways. One, remember that Corinth is the epicenter for the worship of the goddess Aphrodite, the fertility cult. There are three temples to Aphrodite. One of them is massive, and the entire system of worship is led by women, and here's what they did. Every woman who was a priestess completely shaved their head. Every day they shaved their head. It was one of the things that would signify them as I am a priestess of Aphrodite, the fertility cult. And so when you watch somebody walking down the street, a female, she would have unique garb because she's a priestess of Aphrodite and a shaved head. There's one other group of people in Corinth that have short hair, but this would have been like a crew cut, and it's prostitutes. So Corinth is the hub, this port city. There's this crazy sex trade happening, and a woman would just signify her availability. This is how she made her money, by having a crew cut. So it was very distinguishing. So Paul seems to be saying something like this. Guys, all right, you met Jesus. It's true he forgives you. It's true you're not under the law anymore, but it's probably not worth trying to make a statement. Because ladies, if you shave your head, people automatically assume something about you. Guys, if you grow your hair, people automatically assume something about you. These were very distinct cultural things. How about the head covering? Because he says, women, you have to cover your head when you pray. Men, how dare you cover your head when you pray? The irony of this is Paul is Hebrew. He's Jewish. You know what all Jewish men do whenever they pray? They cover their head. In fact, even a devout Jew today wears what? A yarmulke. And it's this sign that we are coming underneath you. We're humbled. We're covered by you. If you go to Israel, or I've been with a bunch of you, you'll go to the Wailing Wall, right? And when you go to the Wailing Wall, you cannot get past the guards unless you have a head covering. Women, you could not get in unless you had a shawl to put over your head. They're deeply, deeply convicted that you come before God and you come before God with a covered head. But in Corinth, Paul tells the men, do not cover your head when you pray. Why? Well, guess who covers their heads when they pray in Corinth? It's the priests to Apollo and Poseidon. They're males. And part of what signified them as priests to Apollo or to Poseidon is they covered their head, and they had this very unique, and they were colorful. One was to Poseidon, the god of the sea. The other is to Apollo, the chief god. And this is their outfit. They just covered their heads whenever they moved. And so some guys are like, hey, I'm going to cover my head. And Paul's like, that just doesn't make any sense if you're a follower of Jesus. Because you're not worshiping Apollo any longer. You're not worshiping Poseidon any longer. Like, just let that go. Quit trying to mix two worlds. It doesn't make sense. So much of this letter so far has been Paul saying this. If you've been around, you've listened to him. It's not all about you. It's not all about what you want to do. Sure, you have freedom. But Paul's saying, listen, don't try to make some statement. This is just going to confuse people. Just because you always wanted to like have a man bun, like don't do it. Don't do it. It's just going to bring confusion to people. So there's a little bit of the cultural context, which helps us understand some, but that's not all the passage, right? We can't just dismiss it all away. So here's number three. This is what Paul does. Paul constantly, when I say constantly, I'm talking about 1 Timothy chapter 2, 3. I'm talking about 1 Corinthians 11. I'm talking about Ephesians 5. Whenever Paul talks about gender, he goes back to the creation story. He goes back to Genesis 1, 2, and 3, because here you have a whole bunch of Greek people, and this is what they believe, that men are in power, men are dominant, women are property. That women, like if a woman cheated on her husband, she's ostracized, the man can just dismiss her. Men have no boundaries whatsoever sexually. That you never love a woman. That was just like a totally foreign concept to a Roman. Like, why would you love her? Like, she's obligated to you. And so Paul says, okay, I want you to think completely differently about gender. I want you to like do something subversive, have a concept that's biblical rather than cultural. So Paul always goes back to the creation story and he refers to it in this text. So here's what we're gonna do. We're gonna go back and walk through Genesis 1, 2, 3. What can we actually learn about gender, how we were designed to operate as males and females in our world today? Genesis 1. God creates the whole world in 5 days. The sixth day is a unique day. It's a day where he is going to create human beings. God has opened up the chapter in this way. He says, let us make mankind in our image. Very curious. God referring to himself in the plural. Let us make mankind in our image. What we have as an introduction to God in Genesis chapter 1 is that he is a relational God. That he is one. There's not a plurality of gods, but he is one, but he is relational. And it's the first time that we begin to understand what will later be defined as the Trinity. That God is Father, Son, Spirit, not in hierarchy. Not like Father most important, Son next most important, Holy Spirit. Sorry, buddy. No. God is relational in his nature. And so when he says, let us make humanity in our image, he's saying, let us make human beings who are one in terms of biology, but who are distinctly unique and could operate the way the Trinity operates. In our likeness. So that also means this, that every human being, male and female, carries the image of God, the Imago Dei. You are not God. You do not have the potential of being God within you, but you have the imprint of the Creator, male and female, on your life. And here's what God says at the end. Up to this, every day of creation, he said it was good. When he makes female, and when he makes male, he says, it is very good. It's very good. So when we are confused, because here's what culture tells you right now. Please don't be offended, but culture is pushing men to act like women and women to act like men. And that has brought so much confusion. When God made male, when he made female, he said, it's very good. It's very good. This is the way I wanted it. This is specific. This is on purpose. So then we move to Genesis chapter 2, which is a different form of genre of literature. It's actually Hebrew poetry. And in chapter 2, we get an in-depth look at the creation story that we just read about, but just day 6. This is that now we know the details. God had taken Adam and formed him out of the dust of the earth, like all the other animals. So he shared this biological reality like the other animals, but this is the very unique thing that God then takes Adam, leans over him, and breathes into his nostrils. This very intimate picture of, have you ever had anybody breathe in your nostrils? Like, right? But here's what God does. He says, you are missing something. You're just like the rest of the animal kingdom. That God breathes into his nostrils the ruha in Hebrew. It means the spirit of life, the breath of life. And this is what makes Adam and Eve different from the animal kingdom, is that into Adam comes spiritual vitality, comes a soul, comes this whole capacity to relate to God like none of the rest of the animal kingdom can. And so he makes Adam, and then he says, Adam, here's what I want you to do. I want you to take care of my garden. I want you to work in concert with me. He says, I'm going to bring all the animals. You're going to name the animals. You're going to be a co-creator in your little way with me. But two problems are identified. They're huge. It's God and Adam. You think, well, that's enough, right? First problem is the garden's really big and Adam can't do it by himself. The second, Adam is profoundly lonely. Profoundly lonely. God like created this whole charade like, hey, let's see if we can find a suitable companion. There's the hippo. Nah, right? Like, no, that's not gonna work. So God creates a setting where Adam identifies that he is incomplete. So what does God do? Causes deep sleep to fall over Adam. While Adam is asleep, he takes from Adam's side a chunk of flesh, a rib. But here's what's important in Hebrew thinking. It's not just biology. It's the side which represents, here's what ancient Hebrews believed, when God breathed life into Adam. You know how you get butterflies? So many ancient cultures believed that like the life source, your soul, was here because you could feel it when you got nervous. So this is very important. He takes from Adam's side, not just flesh, but the very breath of God that was breathed into him. And God says, now from this substance, I'm going to create a woman. She will be your helper. We read helper, we're like, that's kind of dismissive. You know what? God is, he's described as being our helper, the exact same word. David says, God is my helper. It means completer. It means one who like makes it whole. And so now Adam wakes up and he looks and it's Eve and he says, holy mackerel. And he says this beautiful phrase. She is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. We are now together. We now can reflect the image of God more completely. And then here's how the chapter ends. The man and woman were in the garden and they were naked and unashamed. Some of us, like, we go automatically to like, right? But it's not a sexual thought at all. It means this. There wasn't division. There wasn't gender tension. There wasn't manipulation. It's just this comfort of together we reflect God. And God said, remember, she came out of man so that you would cherish her, that you're like, you're my equal because we share the same substance. And then everything falls apart in Genesis chapter 3. It's a conversation between a serpent and Eve, and there's one thing they can't do. God's given you, like, everything's possible, just this one thing. Don't eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Serpent comes along, starts a conversation with Eve. It looks like Adam is present for the conversation. Eve goes ahead, takes the fruit, eats it, and then, please hear this, says she then gave it to her husband, who also ate of it. And this is where it all falls apart. Blame, discord, gender tension. God comes looking, and he doesn't call for Eve, he calls for Adam. Adam, where are you? Adam's response, I'm hiding, I'm punishing myself because the woman that you gave me, she gave me the fruit and I ate it too. God looks at Adam and Eve and he says, oh, because you chose autonomy, here's what's going to happen in your futures. He looks at Adam. He never curses Adam, but he says, now the ground is cursed because of you. And so you will labor and toil and sweat, and it'll produce thorns and thistles that men's, their greatest tension will be a sense of self-worth, a sense of we either overwork or we underwork, that we can't ever provide, that there's a futility to what we do. He looks at Eve and he says, oh, Eve, because of what you've done, here's the consequences. One, pain in childbearing. I just don't think that's about labor, but that's about the deep pain that a mother feels. It's about monthly cycles. It's about stillborn children and miscarriages and children that are lost, like a deep grief that only women can experience. Then it goes on and he says, Eve, and here's the other problem. From now on, your desire will be for your husband, but he will in fact rule over you. Thousands of years of males dominating and mistreating women. God just foresaw it. A fascinating note. Your desire will be for your husband. The word desire is the same word that's used to describe sin the next chapter. That there will be a sense of you'll want power and you'll want to take over by force. that you will want to attempt a coup to take over your husband, but he eventually, because of maybe it's physical strength as much as anything, will rule over you. That's where it ends. And then in Corinth, they're experiencing the same thing. Today, we're experiencing the same thing. Here's what I'd like to do in our next couple of minutes. What can we learn? Like, can it be different? Can it be different? First of all, I'd like to tell you this. What I'm about to say to you is how God intends the church to function. This is not how culture should function. So I know there's a lot of ladies in this room, a lot of ladies watching. You're capable leaders, you're leading industry, you're managing people. And if you try to make this happen in that place, it's probably not gonna work, okay? That's a whole different monkey. But in the church, that's what we're responsible for, okay? So these words are about being in the church. Here's the thoughts. Jesus is the example for both men and for women, okay? He's the example for both men and for women. In Ephesians 5, this is what Paul tells men. He says, men, I want you to love your wives the way Christ loved the church. And you read that, and before that it says, women, I want you to respect your husbands. And that kind of like, that's not fair. But do you know what it means to love your wife the way Christ loved the church? How did Jesus love the church? Sacrificially into death. He didn't stand up for his rights. He stepped towards the void. He, as the innocent one, dies for the guilty. Love, that was unmentionable in Roman culture. You love your wife. So Jesus is our example. If you want to know how to treat women, right? Look at how Jesus treats the church. He's not dismissive, diminishing. He's loving and nurturing. The other part of that would be, Paul brings in from the creation story, he says, men, I want you to think Trinitarian when you think about gender relationships. Does the Father ever dominate the Son? Could you imagine the Father ever being unkind or rude to the Son? Do you think like the whole act of salvation ever happened because the Father got really angry? He said, Jesus, you get down there right now and die for those people. No, because they live in harmony. The Father plays a role. Now for women, this is what Paul says. In the church, in a new created society, women, the way that Jesus respected and honored his Father, that's your role. Like, it's not manipulative, it's not, but the Trinity is always supporting, they're integrated, they're one. They're not trying to find their differences. They're like, we have one goal and one mission together. And so Paul says, here's how I want gender relationships to operate. This is God's original intent. It's like the Trinity. You were made in the image of God, that you're distinct and different, equally valuable, and you have different roles. Different roles, and that's okay. And they're both essential and both absolutely important. In fact, there's a theological term that's used to describe this called functional subordination, meaning that Father, Son, and Spirit are all equal, but in function, they choose to defer. They choose to love. They choose to honor. So, women, I want to say a few things to you, if you wouldn't mind. In the church, we are called to have an environment where you are valued and honored and respected, treated the way the Father treats the Son. An environment where women can know that they will not be preyed upon. Women, please forgive men for stepping backwards and being passive. There's a void. Resist stepping into the void. Resist the ancient temptation of the serpent. If you're a widow, if you're single, if you're a young woman, a girl, if you're married. The church is supposed to be a community where you are protected and loved like the Father loves the Son. Men, what was the first sin in Genesis chapter 3? We look back and we usually identify it as it was Eve. She's the guilty one, right? Eve ate the fruit. You know what the ancient Hebrew rabbis say? They say, oh no. The first sin was not Eve eating the fruit. The first sin was that Adam was there, and Adam had been told by the Father that that tree was off limits. And Adam, the first sin was his passivity and his failure to step up. And so he sees this conversation happening between the serpent and the woman. He's been around. He knows the serpent. He named the serpent. He knows its character. And they have this dialogue. And Adam, some reason, for some way, rather than saying, hey, I got to stop this, rather than coming in and hunting a snake, he says, well, I don't want to offend my wife. She really wants that fruit. It's no big deal. And Adam fades from his responsibility. So now men have a couple of choices from that point on. One is men can dominate. Men can be violent. Men can use and abuse power. Men can subjugate women. Or the other one, it's the sin of our father, Adam, is we hide and we move back and we shirk our responsibilities and we fail to step forward. You know whose fault it was? When God comes into the garden in Genesis 3, who does he call for? He goes, Eve, where are you? He calls for Adam. Adam, where are you? Where were you? So the men, I would just say this. Create environments where you step forward. Don't allow there to be a vacuum. As the Father loves the Son, love women that way. As Jesus loves the church, treat women that way with incredible respect. Be bold. Be sacrificial in your love. Function in the same manner that the Trinity functions. I say this finally to both. Women, when God created you, he said you were very good. It is a beautiful thing to be a woman. Celebrate that. I'm not, like, you know I'm not talking about all these cultural implications. Just enjoy being a woman because God made you that way and it's beautiful. I'm not talking about cultural definitions of femininity. Just be a woman. Men, when God made Adam, he said he was very good. Step towards the void and the vacuum. That's part of your role. Love like the Father loves the Son.
We hope that this helps you take your next step on your spiritual journey. If you'd like to get involved with the work and ministry of Faith Chapel, visit faithchapel.cc and click on Next Steps. If you'd like to speak to a pastor or connect with us in any way, email connect@faithchapel.cc. We look forward to connecting with you soon.